This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's nearly 2 weeks since Hamas, in effect, declared war on Israel. The Israelis' stated goal as of today is the destruction of Hamas, and troops and tanks are sitting on the border with the tiny but densely populated enclave of Gaza, waiting for the order to go in. But what happens next? And what happens after that? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll try to find out. Firstly, there's been talk of an Israeli ground offensive in Gaza for several days now, but it hasn't happened yet. Why not? Shashank Joshi is defence editor at The Economist. Shashank Joshi, before we start talking about what would or could happen if there is a ground war in Gaza, what is the latest we know about the Gaza hospital blast?
We have three main pieces of evidence, and the most important one is the images from the site. And what those images show is that there is little indication of the kind of damage we would have expected from an Israeli airstrike. There's no big crater, for instance. There's no huge damage to the upper side of vehicles or roofs you might expect from an airburst bomb. It is more consistent with what the Israeli claim is, that this was a malfunctioning Hamas rocket. There are two other pieces of evidence which are slightly less solid. One is the voice intercepts of militants from Islamic Jihad, a Palestinian group, talking about their rocket launch. And I know that Western officials are looking into those very closely. And the third piece, which I take seriously, is the American claim that their satellites saw the infrared emissions, the infrared signs of the launch at the time. And that contributed to Joe Biden's decision to say that he concurred with the Israeli assessment.
Right. Now, how difficult is it, just in general, working out who's fired what rocket or launched what drone? And I remember this particularly from the height of the Syrian civil war, when people were trying to work out where the chemical weapons drop had happened from.
It's very hard, unless you happen to have billion-dollar spy satellites and planes that can hoover up electronic intercepts. For us, you and me, looking at publicly available images and videos, you rely on what some people call visual forensics. So, for instance, in the Syrian civil war, if you knew that a blast had come from a particular direction because of the way the shrapnel was distributed on the ground, perhaps the pattern of charring, you could work out the trajectory of the launch, you could trace it back. You could then work out, was that neighbourhood or district held by the Assad regime or a Syrian rebel? So it relies on that kind of detective work based on partial evidence. But I must stress, this is always going to be very rudimentary, preliminary stuff. Of course, it is well above and beyond the sort of evidence we had at our disposal 20 years ago. And to that end, I think open source intelligence, as we call it, is a very powerful force that breaks the state monopoly on intelligence.
This is the thing that which you see in the acronym OSINT now.
OSINT, absolutely right.
Given what you've just said, do you think there are some lessons that we could be learning from the way in which this incident was initially reported and captioned by a whole host of news gathering organisations, including the BBC?
I think it's a profound warning to not rush to judgment in situations where evidence is precarious, very fragmentary. I think the most important thing is that this was based on a Hamas claim. We wouldn't necessarily take a Taliban press release at face value, or one by Al-Qaeda if in the context of Iraq or Syria. In the same way, I'd be extremely wary of international news outlets taking a Hamas press release as gospel truth and allowing those claims to spread. In this case, I think the other lesson is local regional powers, Arab states, even those quite sympathetic to Israel, like the United Arab Emirates, but also Saudi Arabia, Turkey, others, jumped on that bandwagon with very little evidence of their own. And their claims did not just lead to a wave of misleading information going around the world. They also led to the cancellation of a summit between Joe Biden and Arab leaders, which I think shows you how this kind of rush to judgment has profound diplomatic consequences. But a final point to make, David, is that we heard in the first wave of this news, 500 people had died. I fully confess, perhaps I too tweeted or broadcast claims of that nature, for which I now regret. And I think this is a problem, because for this entire conflict, in every Israel-Hamas conflict, we have relied on claims of casualties in Palestinian territories by the Hamas-led health ministry in Gaza. And even Israeli newspapers have used those numbers because there are no alternative credible numbers. But what we have seen from this episode, where we now assess that it is implausible that 500 people would have died except under extreme scenarios, that we have to be more skeptical of some of those casualty figures in the way that all of us have not been really for years.
Now let's talk about the immediate future. An Israeli land invasion of Gaza was being talked about at the end of last week, and it hasn't happened. Why not?
I think there's lots of reasons. I can tell you that Israeli commanders are getting itchy. They're saying to us, we've got to go. We can't stay in this state of readiness for more than a couple of weeks. This is, 360,000 reservists called up. The entire Israeli armored corps has been called up for the first time since the war with Lebanon in the 1980s. The delay is probably down to lots of things. Joe Biden's visit, they're not going to invade while the president's in town. The hope that the Rafah crossing in the south of Gaza would open up, allowing some civilians to leave or aid to come in, which would ease the civilian impact of a ground invasion, which would be very harmful to Israel. There's also concern over the northern front, what Hezbollah might do from the north, and the need to make sure that northern border is completely protected before anything happens. And to that end, they're also waiting on the arrival of a second aircraft carrier strike group from in the eastern Mediterranean from the United States, which will give them some air cover. But I have to say, I think there's also a degree of confusion here in the Israeli political leadership. I'm not sure they have a clear plan. I think Joe Biden pressed Israeli political leaders on this when he sat in on their war cabinet on Wednesday during his brief visit to the country. I think they need to understand, how big will this invasion be? What will its aims be? How many casualties can they tolerate? What happens if Iran intervenes? I think these questions are still being worked out. But I have to say, I still fully expect an invasion to occur. I can't see Israel's political reputation for retribution and for deterrence surviving this if they do not now follow through on what they say they will do.
Now, what's going to be their military goal if they do launch a ground assault? Or are you saying that actually that's not yet determined? I mean, I suppose what people would have imagined, if one takes a sort of kind of very callous, purely military strategy view of it, is that you would anticipate Israel would simply go in and occupy for a while the whole of Gaza and so on, and set about destroying whatever it could find of Hamas. Now, is that what you anticipate the military objective as being?
I'm honestly trying to work it out in my head. The Israeli political aim is to destroy Hamas. Now, how do you destroy a group that has been in power for 16 years in an urban territory, a conurbation of more than 2 million people, where they have, as I told you last week, David, 500 kilometres of tunnels underneath this place, booby-trapped, rigged with explosives, painstakingly prepared. They've now had almost 2 weeks to set up their defence. I've spoken to commanders who attacked Islamic State in Mosul in Iraq some years ago that you'll recall. That operation took months and months and months of painstaking preparation with American intelligence overhead, American special forces leading the way, and Iraqi security forces providing the bulk of troops on the ground. Here we have an Israeli conscript army that will have to do the same thing in this territory that they really don't want to occupy for long periods. But then reportedly, Benny Gantz, the former chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces, told Biden in the War Cabinet on Wednesday this operation could take months. So I think that the war aim is firstly to destroy Hamas's political leadership and to take out as much of their arms and infrastructure as possible. But to my mind, that is the work of months. And to really complete it, it is the work of years. And I'm not sure that that is consistent with Israel's politics and its society right now.
So if you had to guess,
If I had to guess, I think they will conduct a ground invasion soon. I think it will last for many weeks, longer than the invasions of 2008, Cast Lead in 2014, called Protective Edge. But I think they will have to withdraw. But what I think we will then see is a sort of new normal of sporadic airstrikes on Gaza, ground incursions that continue. It won't be the end of the war, even if they have to stop the ground invasion after a few weeks.
Right. That's one scenario. I suppose the other scenario is that they actually do mean what they say and that they will actually go for a full physical destruction of Hamas. And I presume by that it means any kind of military capacity that exists within Gaza. Take us through a bit just how difficult that is. And maybe, given that you've mentioned the Lebanon invasion in the 1980s, which was, I think, I might say, the biggest such operation that Israel had had to conduct, what scale of losses you take?
Well, the Lebanon war in the 80s is a great example, both militarily and politically, because, first of all, it shows you the difficulty of conducting an operation on this scale. But of course, it's a little bit different because Gaza is so much more urbanized and Hamas has technologies today that didn't exist in the 80s. Precision rockets, drones. We've seen them dropping drones on Israeli tanks on October 7th. But the Israel-Lebanon war is a really powerful example as well, because it was a limited operation that was authorized by the Israeli cabinet to try to address a threat on the northern border, on Israel's northern border. It was then used by hawks within Israel's cabinet at the time to turn into a full-fledged regime change in Lebanon, to drive the Palestine liberation out. They invaded and drove all the way to Beirut. And it was not only a sort of quagmire of a war, it was sort of Israel's Vietnam, resulting in substantial losses, not existential losses, but a drip of losses that a small country operating a conscript army cannot sustain. And, of course, it contributed to political dynamics, which ultimately saw Iran come into the country, help establish Hezbollah, the force that torments Israel to this day, and resulted in a strategic situation in Lebanon that hardly solved the problem and indeed in some ways worsened it. And I think this is why many of Israel's friends, those in the US administration and others, are saying, we understand this desire to eliminate the enemy, but trust us, we did this on 9/11. You need a plan, otherwise this could go wrong.
Shashank Joshi. Now I want to explore where all this might lead and how it could be resolved. Joining me in the briefing room are Stephen Erlanger, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent in Europe for the New York Times, who is in Jerusalem, and Professor Lina Khatib, Director of the Middle East Institute at SOAS, University of London. Stephen Erlanger, why has Joe Biden invested quite so heavily in this situation, going to Israel when I believe many in America thought he probably shouldn't?
It was a very courageous trip. I mean, usually presidential trips are planned to the second, and presidents don't go into war zones. Biden risks having to run into a shelter because of missile warnings, but he saw a country, Israel, in a trauma. And in a sense, he wanted to show, at the risk to himself, support for them, just tell them that the United States would stand by them no matter what happens. But he also cautioned them, and I think this is important, he cautioned them not to make the mistake of overreach, not to let revenge dominate their strategic thinking, not to make some of the similar kinds of mistakes America made after 9/11. He wasn't explicit, but Joe Biden himself as a senator supported the American invasion of Iraq after 9/11, something that he later regretted. And he always had doubts about the long American exercise in Afghanistan. So I think those warnings are really an important part of his trip, and also to try to push the Egyptians as well as the Israelis to open up a humanitarian corridor inside Gaza. So I think, you know, this was a very important moment, but there are already Israelis who are saying, you know, that the government of Israel is giving too much power to the Americans to influence how they operate the war. We'll have to see how that goes. But I think Biden's trip was very important for the Israeli spirit and soul, to be honest.
Lina, how do you think the Biden trip was seen by other countries in the region?
Biden was meant to meet with Arab leaders as well on this trip. He was meant to meet with the president of Egypt, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, as well as the King of Jordan. But that meeting was cancelled in the aftermath of the bombing at the hospital in Gaza, Al-Ahli Hospital. And therefore, Biden's visit has now been reduced to just one angle, which is support for Israel. But despite this, all the Arab actors that have a stake in this conflict know that there is no other way than engaging with the United States. And so despite canceling meeting with Biden, eventually they will have to talk to the US, and they are already talking to the US. I mean, there's no escaping it. But I think they're under no illusions regarding, you know, the US support for Israel, which is unwavering. But again, this will not be a surprise for the Arab actors. I think the key thing for them is not whether the US is going to rethink or reshape its relationship with Israel. It's more about what will the US do regarding the regional actors in the Arab world.
Right. Let's deal now with the question of a wider conflict. The US didn't just send Joe Biden to the area. It also sent aircraft carriers and says it's looking to, and this is a quote, deter any state or non-state actor from widening the conflict. Stephen, who are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about Iran, first of all, and they're talking about Iran's cat's paw in southern Lebanon, which is Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is a serious actor. The war with Israel in 2006 was damaging to Hezbollah, and Sheikh Nasrallah, who runs it, expressed regret afterwards for even starting the conflict. I think the Iranians were pretty angry with him for that, because Hezbollah exists really to protect Iran. It's a deterrent. It's not really there to protect the Palestinians. So what the Americans are doing with the aircraft carrier is just trying to say to Iran, don't think about it. And, you know, there are a lot of people in the region who would love to see Iran hit, pull back a notch. There's no question Iran has been very supportive of Hamas. It's supporting Hezbollah. It sees itself as having a kind of hegemonic role in the region, which frankly, the Egyptians hate, the Saudis hate. So despite their criticism of America and the cancellation of the visit with Biden, they actually are quietly very happy that America has reinserted itself even militarily in the region this way.
Lena, how do you see it? And if we could be a bit specific here as well, are the aircraft carriers there to say that if Hezbollah attacks Israel, then American military power will be used against Hezbollah, or that it will interdict Iranian targets? What do you understand the threat to be?
Well, it's definitely a deterrence message to Iran, and Hezbollah is part of that equation as the primary actor where the situation to escalate to a regional war. Because any initial expansion is not going to be from Iran itself, it's going to be from Hezbollah. So that's why the presence of the warships in the Eastern Mediterranean is indicative of everybody's awareness that this is the likely scenario. Now, when it comes to issues widening beyond Lebanon, it's also possible because Iran has groups that are affiliated with it or supported by it in Iraq, in Syria. And it's likely that a front in Lebanon is going to also involve at least some of those actors. So I think, you know, if this happens, then of course the US is not just going to stand there and watch Israel battle multiple fronts. It will be a serious US military involvement, which I think Hezbollah knows what that, you know, would mean for Lebanon, a country that's already quite devastated economically and cannot withstand the price of yet another war. And Hezbollah knows it does not have the domestic support in Lebanon for such a scenario to happen again, because 2006 was bad enough. I think it is an important deterrence move.
Yeah, this may be an impossible question because it asks you to guess at the actions of the Iranian authorities. Do you think they want to see an escalation? Or do you think essentially this is mostly rhetoric?
I still personally think for now this is mostly rhetoric because of the factors that I just talked about, factors to do with if Hezbollah gets involved, then the US will have to get involved and then other Iranian-backed militias will be involved. So it might spiral out of Iran's own control, actually.
Right. Let's talk now about the business of getting a peace. In other words, into a situation whereby fighting stops and so on. And we'll talk about the longer term beyond that after that. Stephen, to have a peace, who can the Israelis make peace with?
Well, at the moment, I think they would have to make a peace with a restored Palestinian Authority. Now, clearly, Mahmoud Abbas has lost a lot of credibility. He's being deeply criticized for what's happening in the West Bank as this Israeli government continues to promote settlements and chewing up bits of the West Bank, which make a separate Palestinian state seem that's contiguous, seem harder to imagine. But there really is no one else. I mean, that is the elected authority, though there hasn't been an election in some time. I think in a way, what is happening, what has to happen, there was this Israeli paradigm that you kind of weaken the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and you keep Hamas stable in Gaza. I think that's over. I think Israel is simply going to have to treat Mahmoud Abbas as an ally, as someone who recognizes the state of Israel and is willing to negotiate with it. And I think this is going to take a big leap of faith, which after the war, I think is simply going to be necessary. And I think the Americans are going to push this very, very hard. So the quick answer is it has to be the PA. I don't know who else it could possibly be.
Just a push question on that. Are there things that the Israeli government, and who knows whether or not it will be this Israeli government at the end of this process, could offer to the Palestinian Authority to make it much more possible for Mahmoud Abbas to take part in this process and actually to give him greater credibility?
Well, it depends on, as you say, what the next Israeli government is and how soon. I don't think Netanyahu will survive this, but how quickly, it's hard to say. I mean, whether there'll be new elections and when. In general, Israeli governments don't survive wars very well, particularly wars that take them by surprise. But I do think a serious recommitment to essentially the principles of Oslo, which is two states for two peoples, restrictions on settlements, boosting the Palestinian Authority over its own people, treating them as partners for peace rather than enemies, traitors. If that can be done, I think that's the only way it can work. And my guess is that if someone like Benny Gantz, who's the most popular opposition politician now in Israel, but who joined this unity government for the war, if he can create a kind of more of a center-right government as opposed to a far-right government, I think that's the direction we'll head. Now, whether the Palestinian Authority has been so weakened in the meantime that it can't be resurrected this way, that's part of my anxiety.
Lina, what's your take on that?
I think Steve presented a very good roadmap out of the crisis. The issue is who has the political will to activate this roadmap. When it comes to the Palestinian Authority, I mean, I mentioned earlier, they have internal divisions that really need to be urgently overcome, and they need to present a unified front. And I think that would make a big difference in terms of the credibility of the Palestinian Authority vis-a-vis some of the Palestinians who are critiquing it, and also would empower its position internationally. But at the same time, the international community that is engaging with the Palestinian Authority has a responsibility as well in this regard. So it's not about one side or another kind of being the only actor able to push things forward. However, I still maintain ultimately Washington is the one that plays the primary role in what happens next.
Well, in that case, can I ask you, Lena, what the capacity is to draw other Arab countries into this process and to what extent they can be useful interlocutors in this process?
I mean, different Arab countries can be useful for different things as well as collectively. And they've already expressed willingness, readiness. They have been involved. So it's not like they have been standing on the side. I mean, Saudi Arabia, for example, remains committed to the Arab Peace Initiative. Egypt remains interested in and being seen as a mediator and facilitator in return for, of course, Western favors. Qatar remains on good terms with Hamas and, in fact, hosts some of the Hamas leadership in Qatar. So it can be used as an interlocutor on the Hamas front. I think the Arab actors are all there. And, you know, I haven't mentioned Jordan. Jordan is, of course, a major stakeholder as well. And they're all ready to work. But I think ultimately now the ball is in the court of the United States when it comes to resurrecting the diplomatic process in a meaningful and serious way.
Can I now turn to the question of the aftermath for Gaza, the particular place? Now, Joe Biden has said that any move by Israel to occupy Gaza with troops would be a big mistake, by which I presume he meant for any length of time, Stephen. You're in Jerusalem. Do you think the Israelis want to occupy Gaza with troops or will feel the need to, or do you think they will actually seek to avoid it?
They certainly don't want to reoccupy Gaza. I mean, they intend to control it long enough to, as they say, dismantle Hamas the best they can, destroy the tunnel city underneath Gaza City. What worries me is, you know, the old Russian proverb about we shall make a graveyard and call it peace. I wonder how much of Gaza City will actually be left once this war is over. But there is no great desire in Israel to stay in Gaza. And of course, as we've heard from Jordan and Egypt, there's no interest in having refugees from Gaza coming there either. So the world will have to help take care of Gazans, and they need help. And I think what we'll probably see is setting up UN and NGO help, particularly in southern Gaza, for all the people there. It's going to be expensive and heartbreaking. And the Israelis will take their time, I think, because they need to try to save as many hostages as they can and to protect their own forces. But this is not going to be a war in Gaza like other previous wars. I've been in Gaza for those wars, and they're bad enough. So what happens later, people talking about it, people have to talk about it, people are thinking about it. There, I think, will have to be some kind of international presence. It's not probably from Western countries, because it's not clear to me that Arab states want to be involved with patrolling Palestinians. I think that's politically just unacceptable for them. But the world is going to have to get engaged with taking care of Gaza, Gazans, and ensuring that after the war, some kind of realistic life is available to them.
Stephen Erlanger there with Lena Khatib. My thanks to them and to Shashank Joshi. My conclusion is there may be routes to peace and a new settlement, and you've heard what it might look like. It's an obvious tragedy that so many people are likely to die and suffer before it's achieved. The Briefing Room is taking a short break, but while we're away, you can listen to The Conflict on BBC Sounds, where Lise Doucette and colleagues provide daily insights on what's going on in Israel and Gaza. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill.
Hello, I'm Melvin Bragg, and I'm back with a new series of BBC Radio 4's In Our Time. We're celebrating our 1,000th episode, so there's an extraordinary range of topics for you to get stuck into, from history, science and philosophy, to religion and the arts. This series, we're discussing Albert Einstein, Ingmar Bergman, Plankton, the Versailles Treaty, and much more. In Our Time is like an audio encyclopedia, we're told, and you can hear it all on BBC Sounds. I hope you enjoy it.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.